Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is AutoLine After Hours with Gary Vasilash and John McElroy, episode 329 for April 22nd, 2016. The Sportage Life.
Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
So, everybody, welcome to AutoLine After Hours. As you can see, John is not here. And if you're listening online, you wouldn't hear John talking at any point in the conversation. And that's because he's not here. So now that we've established John's not here, we will establish who is here. And I'm pretty happy we're going to have a special approach here with Stephanie Brinley with IHS Automotive.
Mm-hmm.
Stephanie, you can say something.
Hi. Hello.
Okay.
thanks for bringing me back again today.
All right. And another analyst, Dave Sullivan of Auto Pacific.
Thank you for unlocking the door for me and letting me in.
We would let you in. And so rather than having journalists, I decided we wanted the all-analyst panel for this week. And our very special guest, all the way from California, Orth Hedrick, who is the Vice President of Product Planning for Kia Motors America. And he was nice enough to bring along with him a 2017 Kia Sportage, the all-new compact sport utility vehicle. Fourth generation, am I correct?
Generation, that's right.
And longest-running nameplate in the Kia lineup
in
the U.S.?
It is. It was the first one that we started with all the way back about 22 years ago. So we're excited to have the new version here with us in the studio.
So. You know, give us a sense of, okay, so fourth generation, so you guys have the opportunity to change things up, right?
Yep.
So when you and your product planners started looking at the vehicle, third generation, what was it that you said, we really need to change it for the fourth?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. When we started working on this latest version, the big move from passenger cars to CUVs was just starting. I mean, we saw some of the growth that was occurring, so we anticipated that there would be a lot of people coming out of a sedan, coming into a much more versatile CUV. I mean, the gap between a sedan and a CUV from the standpoint of fuel economy and handling and all those dynamics has changed so dramatically that it's now a viable alternative, really, to switch from a sedan up. So we had that in mind. We were very mindful of that fact. So with that, we did a lot of work to improve the dynamics, the refinement, the overall styling, and just the overall level of sophistication, I suppose, would be the best way to say it, from the old version, which was more of a utility but mindful of practicality and economy, mm-hmm. to something that was a little bit more premium and aspirational.
Mm-hmm. So somewhat car-like in terms of what it offers, but CUV-like in terms of its overall design and position.
Right. I think for us, the biggest thing that we found in our research is a lot of people really enjoy that fact that you sit up higher. You can see over traffic. The body shape, of course, with the CUV means that you can get a lot of utility, more so than a sedan with a trunk. I think also the all-wheel drive component is a big factor, especially, you know, in a market like here in Michigan or the Northeast. You know, this is another big trend, and I think that has to do with we've had some really horrific three or four winters, especially in the Northeast where mm-hmm. the big metros have gotten hit with a big storm. That sticks in people's minds. When mm-hmm. it comes time to buy a new car, I don't want to go through that again without being ready. So I think CUV offers that capability in addition to a car-like experience and the utility that goes along with it.
Mm-hmm. So you guys offer this as front-wheel drive, and then you have that Magna all-wheel drive.
It's an intelligent all-wheel drive system, Dynamax we call it, where this is our second generation. We have it in our Sorento, which is the CUV just mm-hmm. above this one. Really great technology, and we're really, really happy to have had this applied to the new vehicle as well.
So explain how it works. I mean, it's just sort of clever the way this works.
It is clever. The thing that's unique about it is that it's fully integrated into the actual vehicle electronics. So the component is just not placed in the vehicle. It's actually integrated and stitched into all of the sensors, so it can see the vehicle speed, steering angle, the conditions it can sense from the VDC system, whether you're on an incline or decline. And with all of that, and over time, it has the capability of predicting if it sees an event coming up, which means that it's instantly able to apply all-wheel drive at that moment. So we call it predictive. I mean, it doesn't necessarily read into the future, but it's so fast in reacting, mm-hmm. and it knows the conditions that are bringing on board that it'll turn on that all-wheel drive in a millisecond. When it's not needed, if it's in the middle of the summer, you're just driving down the interstate, it's disengaged, so you're saving fuel. So it's mm-hmm. kind of the best of both worlds.
Is it completely disengaged?
It is completely disengaged. All the coupling is just before the rear axle so that the shaft is still moving, but mm-hmm. The actual mechanism is only steering or powering the front wheels in that case. But mm-hmm. it's watching all the time. And we had it on the previous version. We have it in Sorento. And on this version, since we've worked with the technology since the last one, we were able to do even more integration and work directly with the Magna folks to make sure that we get it right. And it's really, really impressive. Mm-hmm. We just had 120 journalists at the long lead out in San Diego, and we encouraged all of them to take it on a patch of dirt or, you know, find a slick surface and put it through its paces. And we came back with a lot of people that were really impressed. So we're happy to have it on board.
Mm-hmm. I was impressed, so.
It's a nice-looking car, too. Mm-hmm.
With, having a global audience for this vehicle more so than ever, and it kind of rides in that sweet spot globally,
yeah.
That's very popular, is there any type of, you know, what kind of things did you have to, you know, because it wasn't just for you guys.
Right.
This was not a U.S. vehicle.
Right.
So what kind of things did you have to, you know, was there anything you had to compromise on or anything that you had to do different for different markets? Like, how is this vehicle maybe different from the one you would sell in Europe?
Sure. Well, I think probably the first thing is the size. You know, in the U.S., we're used to bigger vehicles. We have longer distances, and people carry a lot more stuff with them and spend a lot more time in the cars. In Europe, in the domestic, the South Korea domestic market, and China, other places, the distances aren't as great. So there was a lot of discussion with regards to the overall length. This one, the new Sportage, actually has the widest width of anything in the category. It's about 73 inches. And with that, we get that really kind of planted look, which we were, you know, that was a big discussion point. You think about some of the old cities in Europe trying to get a wide, big vehicle. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a big vehicle for a lot of metros in Europe. So that was a big discussion point. Since it's, to your point, it's a global vehicle, comes out of one plant, and we had a lot of conversation on that point.
The width helps the interior feel much bigger as
Absolutely.
Well, which is certainly going to play well in the United States.
Absolutely.
In that space, it's a smaller footprint for most U.S. vehicles, but it feels quite spacious inside.
It is, and I think we call it the couple distance. You know, the distance between the two, you're not fighting elbows like you are with someone in the movie theater, for instance. You know, you've got a nice wide console. Storage, the seats are wide enough that, you know, for a lot of people that they can get comfortable and find that ideal driving spot. So it's overall, we're really happy with the size, and it's still compact, so it's maneuverable, which mm-hmm. means you get the utility, you get the feeling of spaciousness, but it's still able to get through drive-throughs and tight parking spots and, you know, garageability. All those points are still very important.
You know, it's interesting to Dave's point about it being a global vehicle. So the design came out of the European studio that Peter Schreier, who's leading up design for you
right.
guys. And, you know, and it looks to me more like a European crossover than an Asian crossover. Was that by design?
Yeah, basically
it was.
It's interesting that the influences that went in for the design, obviously the designers are based in Frankfurt, so their context that influences them are more European. Mm-hmm. And they have, you know, you think about all the other German premium vehicles that are in the area, you know, that's influencing them. Mm-hmm. The architecture, the look and the stance and the design, and the fact that it's, you know, under Peter's careful watch, you know, all the time, there's a lot of work that goes into doing something different.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the face for this is the first time that we've used kind of a disassociated headlight from the grill. You know, normally mm-hmm. the Kias have the signature in the face with our tabbed grill. We call it the tiger nose grill.
Right.
This one's a little bit different. The headlights are up higher, and it has a kind of more of an evocative face, which is new for us.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, for a lot of us, we were really excited about it, but it's a new look, so you have to be really careful. And in the focus groups, it was just off the charts. People just love that new look, and we have it in market now, and it's doing very, very well. We're really mm-hmm. excited about it.
It's got a ton of technology in that car for this price point. And do you expect a relatively high take rate for some of that technologies, or is it partially about helping to make the brand a little bit more aspirational and making sure that you're offering things that maybe some others
it are, is are you know slower? our key differentiation points have always been design, and technology is one of them, quality and safety. So in this generation, it's our newest version of our infotainment system. Right. We call it YUVO, which stands for your voice. Mm-hmm. It's our third generation. So with this, we were able to add CarPlay and Android Auto. It also has capacitive control, so you can pinch and zoom. So you're right, technology is a key part. The other part of the technology story is advanced driver assistance systems. This is one of our vehicles to have autonomous emergency braking, lane departure warning, blind spot detection, a lot of technology, the front dynamic headlights. It's always been for us an important point to have the technology as part of our value story. Mm-hmm. And we were mindful. Part of my job as a product planner is to ensure the content is available at all the different price points. So we were very mindful to get that technology as low as possible. You know, for a lot of other our competition, you have to go all the way to the top grade to get mm-hmm. all the goodies. And here we've added some of those features at a lower price point, just to kind of emphasize the fact that, you know, leather, the heated steering wheel, all those other technologies are all available much, much lower in the grade strategy.
And is that more, are you feeling that consumers are asking for that, or is that more about differentiation and making sure that you have something to give that somebody else doesn't?
It's a pull. It's a big demand. When we do our research, and I think a lot of it is smartphones. You know, everybody has a connected experience either at home or on a smartphone. You get in the car and that kind of drops. So it's a big opportunity for us to kind of bring that into the vehicle at the same time. And that was one of the big points that we were using to develop the new YUVO system, was to make sure that all of that technology is there. We still use the smartphone as the connectivity. So mm-hmm. it's a free service. It comes with in other words, you use the smartphone as the connection, as opposed to having to pay a monthly fee for a modem or connectivity mm-hmm. independent. So we think that's a really
separate data plan that
You've already have, you know, your cable bill at home, you have your cell phone bill and all this other stuff. You don't need another bill. So we're excited about that. That's one of our key points.
This always struck me as interesting. Maybe you guys have noticed this too, but I mean that, you know, when automakers talk about having the availability of, you know, connectivity through the car, that they don't, really don't emphasize the fact that, oh, by the way, there's going to be...
You have to pay for it?
Yeah. I mean...
Well, we heard that in our focus groups. You know, a lot of people said, well, we're really excited about having that connectivity. And we were excited to have both the kids with their laptops or their tablets in the back streaming a movie across the desert, you know, if you're driving to Phoenix or something. It says, then we get the bill at the end of the month of how much that costs. You know, that's not free. That's all that data stream coming through the car is mm-hmm. quite expensive, so...
Well, that's something that consumers have been accepting more and more of, and I don't know where the real breaking point is. I mean, even from some Sirius XM, when those two first services mm-hmm. first came out and it was $10 a month or whatever mm-hmm. it is, and we've just continued to add on to that mm-hmm. expense. And this may be, you know, where consumers kind of break a little bit and say, fine, I'm not going to pay for an extra data point in the car. But we'll see, kind of, because mm-hmm. the ease of that is pretty terrific.
It's a convenience. You know.
If you dump it off on your cell phone bill is going to reflect that ultimately.
You're right.
As well.
Absolutely right.
So it's coming from somewhere. And the other question is, you know, customers understand, I think, that content costs, and the ability to access that content costs money.
What about a OnStar type or BlueLink or one of those type of services? I mean, are you seeing demand then for that if you're saying they don't have a pipe in the car?
It enables a lot of other features that some cars don't have. Remote start from a long distance as opposed to being 300 feet from your car, you know, it enables things like that. So we're mindful of that. We're looking at the market carefully. We're trying to judge whether or not the demand for that type of feature is, you know, what customers are willing to pay for. And if we see a point where it crosses over, we'll certainly add that. We do have modem in some of our cars. The K900, our premium vehicle, has a luxury app that includes that service, mm-hmm. and it also has concierge services. So, and that's all connected through, similar to the OnStar, where you push a button on mm-hmm. the mirror and it goes to a live person.
You kind of touched on something I wanted to ask you about, and that's, you know, we're talking about a a vehicle here that maybe people would have with one or two kids, and then we talk about the K900, which has not exactly wowed the anybody on the sales charts.
Sure.
So what is Kia today? Is it? It used to be, you know, kind of like they play it on this lower tier, you know, very competitive, a lot of value, great warranty. You know, that you could buy a similar car from Kia compared to a Toyota, but it costs less and you got a better warranty.
Sure.
There's a great story to tell there. Now we're talking about a vehicle with all this technology. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know, $35,000-ish
yep.
for this vehicle sitting here. What is Kia today? Is it still, there's kind of the prices have all kind of leveled off to where the competition is at. So where are you guys kind of competing at? Where do you see the brand, especially against that other Korean brand, Hyundai, that has the same warranty and, you know, you guys share a lot of the same vehicles and technology and powertrains. How do you guys differentiate besides, you know, styling? I mean, is there a way that Kia needs to move in a different direction than Hyundai or something to go in a different direction? That's what I'm going for.
Sure. I think probably for us, as I mentioned earlier, the differentiation points for our has always been design, technology, safety, and value. And for us, we're mindful of all those components. The value part used to include only price. You know, you get the stuff for less. But the value equation also can involve feature content at a given price point. So we've added, and I think really we saw a watershed during the recession, the Great Recession. A lot of people came to our brand because we represented value or price. And it was kind of chic and cool to have something that was lower in price and, you know, lived below your means. But we also found specifically for the new Optima that when it came out in 2011, in 2010, we saw a lot of people that really, really loved the car and wanted to know, is there more? I mean, you're onto something. Can you give us more? Mm-hmm. And we added two line extensions to the Optima. We added the SXL model, which is our most premium midsize. And when we launched that car, we were about 40, almost 50% turbo. You know, we have a two engine, it's a 2.4 liter base engine and a 2 liter mm-hmm. turbo. And we were one of the first ones to introduce a midsize without a V6. And we used that turbo, a small displacement turbocharged mm-hmm. to replace the V6. And we had a lot of people trading in BMWs and Mercedes. And that really kind of indicated to us that there is possibilities to move up. And you see in the marketplace that some of the premium brands are moving down into the more mainstream space, you know, the Mercedes CLA, the A3, you know, mm-hmm. some of these other vehicles are moving down and we're moving up. So there's a zone in the middle where both of these brands are kind of adjusting up and other ones are coming down. So for us, the differentiation points continue to be the design. And then with our premium vehicles, we introduced the K900 and the Cadenza, both of those. K900 specifically, I mean, we weren't looking at it as a volume play. We were looking at it as a statement about what this, as a manufacturer, what we're capable of delivering. And I think for us, it was to change people's minds about the perception mm-hmm. of Kia. And that really was kind of the key point of that car. Cadenza, same thing there. It's a premium vehicle. And all of the vehicles that we are introducing above the median price of the general market now is about $32,000. Mm-hmm. You know, those are, we over-deliver in value for the given price. So if you look at a K900 compared to its competitive
right.
set, and if you look at a Cadenza, and same thing with Optima, we have a lot of content and a lot of value.
Well, Optima had to be a game changer for you guys.
It
I
was.
Mean, the current Optima,
yes.
I mean, that you guys basically put yourselves on a map in a way that Kia hadn't existed before. I mean,
no,
they were back to what you were talking about earlier, Dave, that it was something that was,
everything, though, like even on the higher trims on the Optima, then the lighting at night, the exterior mm-hmm. lighting was, I mean, it really, you could, it set it apart
yeah,
on the road.
Yeah, it's very compelling.
Yeah.
And it's had legs in the market, too, I mean, in terms of, yeah. you know, its appearance. I mean, sometimes I'll see a car across the parking lot, and I'm like, oh, what the hell's that? Oh. And it's,
yeah,
you know,
it's,
and it's
does. But in a lot of ways, too, that kind of like, you know, the Optima or the Sonata, which were both big style, you know, in terms of styling, mm-hmm. they kind of disrupted the,
right.
I hate to use that word, but they really did disrupt that segment a little bit, because now you look at Camry and what they tried to do and, you know, trying to move, you know, something that they never did, what was last year, with the Camry and, you know,
where they changed all the sheet metal, but the roof. But
yeah, I mean, everybody. I mean, so yeah, these guys probably, you know, have a lot of responsibility for, you know, making that mid-sized segment change.
And I think that, you know, what we're seeing here with the Sportage is again that, you know, you guys are amping it up in a way and, you know, and making a shift that perhaps will put you in that position.
Sure.
In this segment. Now, so how does this vehicle do for you guys in market versus other products?
Well, this we just replaced. This is our fourth generation. The last version, up until it's in market still. We have a few of them left over, but it sales between that and the Sorento, we were up about 16%, even in this last year. Mm-hmm. So I think both of those vehicles kind of benefited from the move to CUVs.
And are you going to have a problem getting in enough?
Yeah.
We're working with the, you know, we have a second plant over in Slovakia where they build it for the European market. So we're negotiating. It's a negotiation point that we have to kind of balance. And I think we're asking for as many as we can get.
Mm-hmm.
We were in, just after the New York Auto Show, we had a dealer dinner, and they all inundated our CEO with requests for more, 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 more. And he was on the phone. That he says, I've called back there. He says, I've asked for more. So he says, I'm doing everything we can. So it is, I think that kind of the rapid movement to CUVs has really kind of caught a lot of everybody in the industry off guard.
So as the guy who's running product planning for this company, I mean, how do you see sedans going forward? I mean, is it going to become like a smaller part of, you know, your business or
right.
any car maker's business for that regard?
They're still giant segments. I mean, you look at compact and midsize. I mean, they're still, what, number two and number three now?
Mm-hmm.
I think they're big markets, and there's a lot of people who still want a nice midsize sedan. Not everybody wants to be in a CUV. So there's still, you know, a very strong buyer set.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of people who just want a commuter car, a dual-use vehicle, you know, compacts represent a great challenge. It's a brutal market, though. I mean, the competition is unbelievable. And
so you have Forte in that market?
We have Forte. We have we're going into production in our newest North American plant.
Right, the Mexico plant.
In Mexico plant. And about a month from now, we'll start seeing the refreshed version of the Forte.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be coming out of that plant. So our presence in that compact market has really been restricted because it's another global vehicle. It comes out of only one plant, and that's another one where we had to negotiate. So the fact that they put this new plant in North America really helped us out. So we're hoping to get...
Why wouldn't you build crossovers in Mexico then instead of...
Well, that vehicle is... that plant is not necessarily just for North America from the standpoint of the U.S. It's also allows us to have a presence in Central America. You know, there's a big growing mid-size or middle-class market down there,
mm-hmm.
Central America, and then also South America. So that is kind of a more of a global play.
Mm-hmm.
So we're part of the equation. We're not the whole equation.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, we lobbied hard to get a vehicle that was specific for us, but, you know, we were told that this is a global production facility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why we were the Forte, which we're excited to have. It's a great vehicle. We have three body styles. We have a turbocharged engine, and we're looking to do really well with that vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we have a more supply of it.
Last question to you.
Well, we talked about the recession and sort of
yep.
buying habits have changed, and we're expecting that later this year, next year, we'll see interest rates come up. And right now, we're coming off of a few years where people are really willing to spend some more money and get
right.
some premium content. Are you watching sort of that interest rate, and what do you expect consumers to do once their purchasing power starts to deteriorate a little bit?
Well, it's interesting you mention that because we're seeing a trend now where the terms, the monthly terms,
right.
the length of terms has gone up quite a bit.
It has.
The percent of subprime buyer market has expanded, which means more and more of the auto industry is going deeper, and what we refer to as buying deeper. We also see percent of lease increasing as a way to get the payments down.
How many people lease, you know, approximately what leasing is for Kia buyers?
I don't have the exact number. I think it's roughly around 30%. I'm not sure about that point, but I know that it is growing. And for us, that really kind of is an indication that, you know, we're stretching. Mm-hmm. We're seeing incentive levels, especially in midsize segment. It's really increasing a lot. So maybe this is kind of maturing. Everybody's going to have to throttle back, but no one wants to be the first one to slow down production.
All right. Well, with that,
Orth, I want to thank you for coming.
I appreciate
thank you for bringing this car. You know, I've had the opportunity to drive it, and I think if anybody is in the compact market right now, they ought to take a look at this crossover vehicle. So
awesome. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to come in.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being here.
All right. So we're going to take a break, hear from our friends at Bridgestone and Lear. So we'll be right back.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, and we're back. So at this point of the show, we always call on Dr. Data, but since that's me, I guess I have to call on myself. So we're going to do something a little different this week because, as I said earlier, in the that we have these two brilliant analysts here. And so I want you guys to think about this and chime in on what I'm getting to here. So, Carmen, can we have the first slide here? It will be here shortly. All right. So what we're looking at here, for those of you who are listening to this and can't actually see this, is the fact that I took a look at the sales numbers for Cadillac and Lincoln, okay? And so this is the first quarter numbers for both of those. So the interesting thing, I think, is that if we look at the total Cadillac sales, as we can see now, this is first quarter, 35,633, which is down 4.1% from the first quarter of 2015. And then we can see that Cadillac has the ATS, CTS, CT6, ELR, XTS, Escalade, and SRX. Now, if we look at the Lincoln numbers, we can see that they're 24,905, which is up 16% from the first quarter of 2015. And that's the MKS, MKZ cars and the MKC, MKT, MKX, and Navigator crossover utility vehicles. Okay, so I'm looking at these numbers and I'm seeing, okay, first of all, there's not that great a delta between the two numbers for the first quarter and the fact that one is up 16% and one is gone down 4%. My question to you guys is it possible for Lincoln to catch or even pass Cadillac? And I'm not talking about like sometime in the future. I'm talking about in perhaps even the near future.
I don't think it's going to happen in the near future. I think what we're seeing here right now, too, is MKC and MKX impact. Because right now, Lincoln has two relatively fresh SUVs. Cadillac's coming with XT5, and it's hitting dealers any minute, basically.
Yes.
So they'll have that. But I think that's where we're seeing some of this gap and where we're seeing some of Lincoln be able to gain some ground. Later this year, they'll come out with the Continental, but there's still a smaller overall number of brands and number of vehicles in the lineup.
Just to echo what she said, I mean, it's all having fresh product and fresh product and what's hot, as we just talked about with Orth, crossovers.
Yeah, all the
Cadillac
fresh
has one,
what
one crossover,
so
and last
Escalade,
year, no, that's not a crossover.
Well, it's but I mean, but that's
it's in there. It's outselling the Lincoln.
But those stuff,
it outsells the Navigator. So
right, okay, so it's a big number, and then they've had SRX, and SRX sales have been doing very well,
even at the end, towards the end of its
toward the end of its life.
Well.
Now it's got the XT5, which we had in studio here a few weeks ago. Very nice vehicle. Mm-hmm. I mean, well done. But you know, so Lincoln's got the MKC and it's got the MKX, both of which are doing fairly well. Navigator's doing okay. And then, you know, I'm looking at it from the point of view of, okay, they come out with the reasonably priced Continental, right? They had pricing for that
$45,000,
which, so it makes it lower than the price of the CT6, right?
Yes.
Right. CT6 is what, 54? Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So. And isn't this sort of the car that everybody's been waiting for to come from Lincoln?
Yes, and they'll do well with it, but I still think that longer term, I don't think they're going to quite catch Cadillac just yet. And Cadillac does have other product coming. Lincoln's future product lineup is not growing in terms of a lot of a new volume, new products, where mm-hmm. Cadillac is working on new SUVs and filling the holes that they have right now. And I don't think that Lincoln's filling as many of those holes.
Well, as we know, I mean, F-Series has been a... Yeah. They know how to build pickups at Ford. They have not been able to nail, since the late 90s, building SUVs. You know, I'm looking at Expedition and Navigator. I mean, they used to be... They invented that segment with the Navigator, basically.
Right.
And they've kind of gave up.
The Navigator concept really...
Exactly, this is what I'm getting at.
Yeah,
if you looked at that
Navigator
concept that came out in New York, they're not going to sit back anymore. I mean, they're doing their homework. They're putting in the money into this program to make it a real, viable competitor to the Escalade. So it's to say it may never happen...
Never is a little too far out there,
but they're doing the things that they need to do that could make that happen.
And Navigator will be interesting when it comes out too, because there's again more Cadillac product coming out as well. But still, as large as the Navigator is, even though this concept preview is something that'll be pretty amazing, it's still a smaller part of their mix.
Yeah, it's only like 10,000 units a year or something.
And that's
smaller
not
part
really...
of Lincoln's mix than the Escalade is of Cadillac's mix.
Yeah, they're both small percentages compared to the overall, because it's just the size of that SUV precludes it being the higher volume product.
Would I rather sell? I'd rather sell those than you know, they make more money on those than you would selling an ATS.
So basically, what you guys are saying is that my thesis that perhaps Lincoln could catch Cadillac.
You got a refresh on the MKZ with some potentially very, you know, important powertrain changes as well. So new face and new powertrains. So, I mean, they're doing a lot in a very short amount of time for the brand, considering that they haven't really done much in the last 10 years. There's a chance.
But they got momentum.
I think too, they've spent a lot of time over the last 2 years really looking at how they treat customers in the dealership and trying to push as many levers in there as they can. And I think, honestly, I think that's one of the things that's paying off a little bit as well.
But isn't everybody doing that now, though?
Yeah, it is. But they're
all going to be a cappuccino.
They're all saying that. But I don't. They're all saying that. I think there's some depth to their to their comments.
All right. So we're going to move on to a different subject, and so since we just had this serious discussion of numbers and things like that, we're going to sort of lighten up things a little bit here, a little change. We haven't done this. I don't think we've ever done this before. But we're going to talk about electric vehicles here in a minute. But first, we want to talk about a brand new vehicle that had its debut this past Saturday night. So Carmen, could you please show us a brand new electric car?
If you're a podcast listener, stay tuned. This video clip was blocked by NBC Universal and is unable to be played.
So that, of course, was from Saturday Night Live. And actually, Mercedes followed up with a tweet about that. So as we can see here, that they're offering that recharging station. I think that with those four slots, it would take one quite a long time. Part of this was that last week the nascent car company Faraday Future broke ground for a $1 billion assembly plant in North Las Vegas to build electric vehicles.
Didn't break ground. They're still grading it.
Doesn't that, when the thing goes in there, isn't that breaking ground?
They put a shovel on the ground.
There was a shovel used. That's groundbreaking. So here we have... Chip Drake, producer, had found that back in the late 70s, there was actually a skit that was on Fernwood Tonight, which also was batteries. But in that point in time, there's the groundbreaking, it was all about, we had this energy crisis. Now we don't really have such an energy crisis because we have $2 a gallon gas. So Faraday Future, or the future of other electric vehicle companies, what do the analysts think?
Faraday's got some serious challenges. They've put out a timeline. We'll see kind of where they...
But they have... So what's their timeline?
They're saying get a plant up and running in half the time it'll take most people to make it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, then they came back and said that's what they want to do, but it might not quite make it. So we're already seeing some hedges bet, some bets hedged there. But the other thing that they've
done...
Is that
Las Vegas joke?
It is a Las Vegas joke. The other thing that they've done is they've hired a lot of people, and they've hired a lot of talent. And if you talk to a lot of CEOs about what their biggest problem is in terms of keeping the company going, and their biggest concern tends to be human resources and, mm-hmm. and the talent within the company. And so they've hired a lot, and that can help them get along to where they need to go, maybe a little bit faster than we think.
Yeah.
What do you think? There's a lot of money behind this, yes. Okay? The guy that basically started the Chinese equivalent of Netflix is behind this, and he seems to have very deep pockets, regardless of what's going on in the Chinese economy right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really think he's going to take no for an answer here. Now, why they're doing it here versus in China, I don't know. But, this is a very interesting, you know, the push-pull, economics class question comes in here.
Mm-hmm.
They said they're spending about $1 billion.
Right, for the assembly plant.
Yeah, for batteries, right?
No, this is a plant to make cars.
They're going to be building
batteries
as well.
According to them, this facility will be the formative breeding ground for our vision of future mobility.
It's
the car plant.
There's kind of been this idea that they're not going to sell vehicles in a traditional manner.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe they're going, either be some sort of
door-to-door or
sharing, or some sort of you lease a piece of it, or mm-hmm. kind of like an Airbnb type of car.
Right.
So we really don't know what they mean, but it's going to be something a little.
It's going to be a little off the beaten path, but they've got a lot of competition in that because the traditional OEMs have, stepped off, and they're looking on into all of these mobility issues
mm-hmm.
and different business models and researching and buying talent that they need and trying to figure out where they're going to go forward. So Faraday doesn't own the idea of reevaluating what mobility is.
Right.
And the people that are getting involved in mm-hmm. this also have tremendous history in understanding the automotive market and how to build things and how to not mm-hmm. crash them and all sorts of things. So Faraday's got a lot of ground to catch up on.
Right.
And they're going to have a very stiff competition. When Tesla came out and felt like it was really fresh and kind of the only people doing what they were doing, Faraday doesn't have that advantage.
Mm-hmm.
By the time in 2018, 2020, when they start mm-hmm. really rolling out what it is, everybody else is there
too. I thought it was interesting also this week that two supplier companies, the German company Siemens and the French company Valeo, announced that they were getting together and they were forming a joint venture. The joint venture's purpose is to provide electric motors and onboard electronics and all the stuff that a company would need to be able to create an electric vehicle. And so I begin to wonder, if we look at the sales even of hybrids in the U.S. market right now, they're really suffering. Is this a long play, or
it's part of the consolidation that I think is going to have to take place? I mean, there's not enough volume for like suppliers to make this viable for their business. I mean, whether you're developing motors for all of these different OEMs or batteries, whatever it may be, there's just not enough volume there.
These guys are basically saying it's like one-stop shopping. So Siemens is making motors and Valeo is making the
exactly.
thing.
Well,
and so just go
right.
go to this one place and get the whole kit rather than going.
They have to. I mean, in order to keep the cost down, they have to work together to basically offer a package deal that makes it easier. Hey, we're gonna do.
But I mean, consolidation sort of implies that things are getting smaller. It seems to me it's quite mm-hmm. the opposite. Things are actually getting bigger. If here's this company from China is building a $1 billion plant for electric vehicles in Las Vegas, here's a company that's basically saying the Germans and the French are going to get together. When does that happen? And we're going to have this new business and we're going to headquarter in
consolidation
Germany.
Looks to reduce cost. not
right.
to reduce sales. So the consolidated company should be bigger than the company that was before.
Right.
Not smaller. But
if you can offer the software all of these things that...
Particularly for manufacturers with fewer resources. Mm-hmm. So you'll see some manufacturers continue to develop everything themselves and go that route. But at Mazda, there's some others there that might be a much more viable option. And really, we are seeing EV sales are down even in the first quarter of
right.
this year again. We still have that issue between what consumers want and what regulations and emissions requirements are going to force.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is cost and getting that cost down. What auto manufacturers are also doing to help alleviate that is with every generation they give, the vehicle has the and. I mean, it's not going to be enough to get consumers to go to EVs mainstream, which is still quite some time away. It has to be something more than just an electric powertrain. It has to be exciting in some other way. It has to be fun to drive. It has to be practical enough to be able to do what you want to do. It has to have an and factor.
Mm-hmm.
Volt has grown up in the second generation because it needs to be a real car, not just a technology mm-hmm. powertrain. And that'll continue to evolve. But the other part of it is suppliers getting together and some consolidation in terms of research and development and production.
The interesting thing to think about too is that there's a gamble or a thought that the tide of diesel is going to turn in Europe. And so just this week, or maybe it was Linda last week, LG Chem announced that they are going to build a new battery plant to make 230,000 packs a year in Poland.
Mm-hmm. And LG Chem provides the Volt battery
yes.
right now. And
they do about three or four other European OEMs as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, to that fact, I mean, they're trying to put the capacity in place now in case, diesel, something happens. I mean, we already have seen in France.
Diesels are going to be going down in Europe.
Yeah, in France, diesel's already going out of favor at a bureaucratic level. They're trying to take, they don't want them anymore. So they'll really try and move, we're going to see EVs and plug-ins get pushed even more there. So LG's kind of looking at going, hey, the demand could be coming. We're going
right.
to break ground on this plant. And so that's what they're doing in Poland.
So basically, maybe some of this is just positioning, saying that as the diesel,
it's the long term play.
Right.
It's not just diesel. It's all the emissions issues and electrification being part of the solution.
CO2 issues.
CO2 right. Because they've got that.
It's 2025. It's 2030. It's
2021. I think in Europe for the next.
But you can't. These investments right. and these discussions are not just about 2021. They're looking at what the next thing is going to be, because whenever you hit the 21 mark, they're mm-hmm. going to be looking at something else. It's mm-hmm. not going to stay there until.
Right.
Fill in the blank.
Yeah, the target's moving.
Constantly moving target. Well, and that won't change.
And speaking of electric vehicles, and you mentioned the Volt, and I happened to be driving a Volt last week, and I know that John had one a couple weeks ago, and he'd mentioned that, when you're driving under electric power, it's a whole lot of fun. And I noticed that when you weren't driving under electric power, it wasn't so much fun. Okay, so this week Chevrolet announced that the Chevy Cruze, the all new 2016 Chevy Cruze, will have a highway fuel economy of 42 miles per gallon. Okay, so I thought, that number looks familiar to me. So I pulled out the paperwork for the Volt, and I discovered that after you deplete the battery and you're running on the extended range,
you're 42.
Generator, it's 42, right? 42, 42. They're both compact cars, right? So then I was thinking, let's look at the size of these two vehicles. So the passenger volume for the new Cruze is 93.5 cubic feet. The passenger volume for the all-new Chevy Volt, 2016 Chevy Volt, is 90.3, which basically means you're giving up 3 cubic feet of space for passengers, which is a non-significant number. So then I looked at the base price of a Chevy Cruze, mm-hmm. 2016 Chevy Cruze, which comes in at $16,120 before all that other stuff, right? So this is just the base price. The base price for a Volt is $33,220. Okay. Has Chevrolet just shot the Volt in the foot?
No, I think it's a totally different buyer.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I would think. I think it's a totally, first of all, we aren't talking about a lot of people stepping up to plug-in hybrids right now anyway. And it is a different buyer. It's a buyer that's going to be excited about the 53 miles range of electric they're going to get out of the Volt. And recognizes that when you've got the battery powertrain and the battery charged, it's a little bit more fun than without. It's a different buyer. So I don't think that it's killed the Volt.
You know what would have really helped the Volt is bringing that, not the MPV version that they brought that was kind of that Orlando thing from, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, but if they did it in like an Equinox or something that sized crossover, if they did that, I think that would be much more popular, and you know, that's what people want.
You're saying a small crossover electric vehicle.
Give it the body style people want.
All right.
I mean, you get in a Volt, you're still giving up. You know, yes, they added a sort of third seat in the back, but it's still really tight back.
Right.
There.
I mean, but my point is that you know, if you're somebody who doesn't have the opportunity to charge the thing all the time, mm-hmm. which is the predicate of the that,
then you don't buy that car.
Right. Okay. Okay, so let me ask you another question. So then I was thinking, okay, the Chevy Malibu. Now, Cruise, when it came out, it really ate into Malibu sales. Now, they both are basically all new cars.
But the Cruise and the Malibu were actually
close in size.
They're very close in size, and actually some of the specs of the Cruise were actually larger than the Malibu.
Okay, so now we have a new Malibu.
Bigger Malibu.
So is there going to be a crossover? So you don't think that...
I think that the size of the cars is just significantly different enough that, you know, every generation cars get a little bit bigger. And
except for the Malibu. When the last one came out, it was...
So the Malibu has, for passenger space, it's 102.9 cubic feet of space, and the Cruise is 93.5.
But look at the overall length and the wheelbase numbers, too. And the Malibu is 10 or 12 inches longer than the Cruise. And that means a lot when you're driving it on the road in terms of what where you're parking it and how you're getting it around and what you're comfortable with.
Okay, so you guys, do either of you think that having three cars that are basically similar, that they're going to step on one another or no?
No.
I don't think these three will.
No,
I think they've positioned them now much better than they had in the past. And I mean, the Volt really doesn't. Well, one, you're not going to sell them to people getting in carpool lane access anymore, since you can't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And that kind of takes away one of the big reasons why people bought it. But the other ones are really, I mean, the price points are so different, and you're not going to go buy a Volt, even though the price is on top of a Malibu. You're just not going to go. They're not really same buyer at all, so I'm not really too worried. I wouldn't be too worried about it.
No.
Now, the old Malibu and the Cruise, they were
too close.
They were way too close. And then the incentives on the Malibu, you can get one for less than a Cruise quite often.
I was going to say that's the bigger problem for both of those two cars is how competitive that sedan segment is, on both the compact and the midsize sedan segments.
Meaning what?
That's their biggest hindrance for sales. It's just that those markets are so competitive, like Orth was saying earlier.
Uh-huh.
They're really incentive trained mm-hmm. highly, so people kind of expect incentives even on newer product in there, and it's just fierce trying to make sure you get those buyers. So that can impact how much those sales can grow.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's a bigger problem for sales for these vehicles than competition from the internal showroom.
Okay, so I want to ask you guys about, so staying sort of with this electric thing that we've had this sort of theme going here. So last week Sergio said that he could build a Model 3.
In 12 months.
In 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
He also said something about his new targets for consolidation. It was a Ford and what was the other one?
Volkswagen and Toyota.
So, okay.
Everybody.
So, isn't this sort of like saying, you know, I could be the tallest guy in the room despite the fact that Dave's like a foot taller than I am?
No. This is my take on what he said last week. Look, there's still a lot of people, especially in a political season here, about what happened with getting bailed out. That being said, if FCA merged or whatever, bought out, got bought out, whatever they want to call it, with say, a Chinese company, they could, Marconi can at least come back and say, look, I tried with GM. I tried with Ford. I tried. But he's not going to come out and say, yeah, I think we'd be great with XYZ Chinese company, and that's what I want to partner up with. You're not going to come out and say that, so because you'll get killed. So he's coming out and saying, I tried to do it with these guys. They wouldn't do it. So, you know.
So, but here's another question. If one of FCA's challenges is a slight lag in some technology compared with the Detroit manufacturers and Toyota and Volkswagen, and if they did end up merging with a Chinese company that also is not as technologically strong as the other competitors, aren't we yet again putting two weak players together and expecting magic to happen?
What if they're not really buying it? They just want Jeep.
Still.
I mean,
the resulting company, if you've got things that are weak and you put them all together, they don't get stronger.
Just not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that they're looking for a knight in shining armor to come in with a sack of cash.
So all the stuff that he's saying is cagey strategy on his part.
I think so.
Yeah.
And do you think that...
He also said that he didn't think that it would happen until after he's gone.
When's he gone?
18. So he also doesn't think that a merger or a consolidation would be executed until after he was gone, mm-hmm. which means the deal may be made, but none of the major happened.
I get worried about is that if we do have a downturn and that or some global crisis and fuel goes up and Ram sales go down or Jeep sales go down, the value of the company could potentially take a hit, which either that means they could be maybe they'd be more liable to be taken over, or nobody wants them because they're too heavy into trucks and that could bring somebody down. I mean, one of those two things could happen, but it's just to walk away from cars, Dart 200, we screwed up. They were, you know, Marconi saying at the Detroit show that, you know, that the 200 was...
It basically
horrible.
Said it was poorly designed.
Yeah, I mean, calling out the designer saying that it was screwed up the rear doors. And to me, it's just like I really kind of trimming the company and getting rid of some of mm-hmm. the fat and the things that don't make money to make the company more presentable. Mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't really get a chance to date GM. They rejected him. They look at him and say, pretty ugly. So... Now he's trying to get the company in shape, you know, trying to lose some fat and tone things up. So, you know, lose the things that aren't making any money, like the 200.
So what about the Model 3 claim? You know, he's saying if Musk can make money and he can do that, we'll do it in a year.
But it has to have Italian.
He would bring it with Italian flair, and that would make it better. And I don't know that the 500, Fiat 500 sales so far have not exactly spoken to the fact that Americans are clamoring for that Italian style. So I'm not entirely sure that would be the difference maker, at least in the U.S. market for a...
But, I mean, is it even conceivable that you could do a car that fast?
Probably not.
Probably. It seems a lot. They do have some EV technology already, but, you know, I mean, he's also the same guy who came out and said, don't buy my 500E because I'm not making any money on it. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a bold comment, but I think the comment was much more directed at thinking that the $35,000 for the Model 3 was too low. It was more that than it really was about
what he's going to do. More of saying, like, this is how far-fetched his number is. You know, if that was real, I would be doing it myself, but I already know I can't do it. So Musk is out of his mind.
Pretty smart guy to be out of his mind, but...
Hey.
He hasn't made any money yet, but we'll see. Well, okay, so I think that we've beaten somebody to death. So I want to thank you both for being here.
Thanks Stephanie, for having me come by.
IHS
Thanks.
Automotive. Mm-hmm. Dave Sullivan, thank Auto you. Pacific. So there will be no show next week because everyone else will be in Beijing. So we were talking about China here a little earlier. Yeah. So John and the crew will be visiting the auto show there. Are you guys going to the auto show there?
No.
I'll be in with Volkswagen and their annual press conference. That'll be interesting.
You'll be in Germany?
I'll be in Germany.
Okay. So we'll have to have you back to tell us what you learned in Germany at some point here.
I'm looking forward to
it. I'm not invited back to that anymore.
You're not invited back there anymore?
I was a rabble rouser at that.
I can't imagine that, Dave. I mean, that you were being a rabble rouser. Okay. So they're probably. So, all right. Follow Autoline, facebook.com/Autoline Network, all one word, Autoline Network. Follow Autoline on Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline. I want to thank you all for joining us. I hope you enjoyed the show as much as I did. So thanks and see you in a couple weeks.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.